Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you once again from Longmont, Colorado. I'm your host, Mark Troutman. This educational personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. This is the final episode of the six-part financial literacy miniseries. Today, I will briefly cover the topic of income taxes and wrap up the miniseries by highlighting the primary lessons we learned summarized on a simple index card. So let's get started. The first tax form I like to cover with most young people especially is the W-4. This is the Employee's Withholding Certificate. Frequently, it's done online, but it's done whenever you start a new job, and it enables the employer to determine how much withholding should be done from your paycheck for federal and state tax purposes. You're going to enter your personal information, name, address, social security number, and your filing status, and then it's going to ask you a series of questions about other income you might have from other jobs, if you have dependents. It's going to ask about any other income you might have that's not subject to withholding, any special deductions, or any extra withholding you want to do. Now, for students, I like to mention that you can be exempt from withholding if you satisfy two tests. And that is, you had no federal income tax liability in the prior year, and you expect to have no federal income tax liability in the current year. If that's the case, if you're doing it online, you can check the box for exempt. Or if you're doing it in the print form, you can write the word exempt in step 4 under 4C. And then you sign it, date it, and hand it to your employer. So I like to point this out because a lot of people are unaware that if their income is low enough, they can avoid having federal income taxes withheld and not have to file a tax return in order to get a refund for those taxes. Now let's talk about a few of the forms that you will likely receive either in the mail or electronically, generally in January, the main one being the W-2 wage and tax statement, and you will receive this for each employer, and it will list a lot of information useful for filing your taxes. It will have your social security number, so very important to check to make sure that that is correct. It will also show the employer's name and the employer identification number, which is effectively the tax ID for the company. It will show your name and address, and then it's going to show some figures in various boxes. The two key boxes are box 1, which is wages, tips, and other compensation, and that is useful for filling out your tax return, and box 2, which is the federal income tax withheld from your paycheck. Then it's going to also list in box 3 your Social Security wages that were subject to tax for Social Security taxes withheld, which is listed in box 4, and in box 5, Medicare wages, in box 6, Medicare tax withheld. And then you may see something in box 13, like a check mark in the retirement plan box, if you had a 401k, 403b, or something of that nature, retirement plan. And then in box 12, you might see a number of letter codes and numbers next to them. So a few that you might see are code D, which is elective referrals under a 401k plan, code E, elected deferrals under a 403b plan, or code G, which is elected deferrals under a 457B plan. You might also see a double A letter, which is Roth contributions to the 401k plan, a double B, which is Roth contributions to a 403B plan, or a double E, which would be Roth contributions under a 457B plan. The other one you typically might see is double D, which is the cost of employer-sponsored health coverage, which is not taxable. It's more for information purposes so the employer can show you how much money they paid on your behalf for health insurance. And then at the bottom of the W-2, you'll see information pertinent to your state. So the state that your wages were earned in, the letter code for that, the employer's state ID or tax number, the state wages that were subject to tax, and the state income tax that was withheld. You might also see information in boxes 18, 19, and 20 for any wages that were taxed on a local basis. So it could be a municipality or a city, and the tax withheld and the locality code that either the city or municipality that was the taxing authority. So that's the W-2. You might also receive a number of other tax documents, so keep an eye out for these in the mail. And these would include things like a 1099 INT, which is interest income from like a bank account, a savings account, a CD. You might get a consolidated 1099 from an investment company. And inside that 1099 would be 1099 INT, which would be interest income from the investment account, 1099 DIV, which is dividends from the investment account, and 1099 B, which is proceeds from broker transactions from the sale of securities and information regarding short-term and long-term gains and losses. Other 1099s you might receive are 1099 NEC, so that's non-employee compensation. So if you did some 1099 work for a company, you might receive that. You might get a 1099 MISC, which is really a catch-all for other kinds of income. I've gotten them before for, let's say, a referral bonus of a credit card, and I got a referral dollar amount, and I got a 1099 MISC for that. You could get a 1099 G, which is for certain government payments, usually like unemployment compensation or state and local income tax refunds. You might get a 1099 Q, which is payment from qualified education programs like a 529 plan. If you're retired, you might get a 1099 R, that's distributions from pensions, annuities, retirement or profit sharing plans, IRAs, things like that. A 1099 SA, which is distributions from a health savings account. If you have a mortgage, you'll get a 1098, which is the mortgage interest statement. If you're a student or parent of a student, you might get a 1098 T, which is the tuition statement for tuition payments received and billed, and for scholarship grants for the student. You might also get, very likely, a 1095, and it may be a 1095A, which is a health insurance marketplace statement for ACA coverage and premium tax credits, 1095B, which is health coverage from an insurance company or a government agency like Medicaid or Medicare, or 1095C, which is employer-provided health insurance coverage. So all of those 1098, 1099, 1095, make sure you keep those because you will need those in order to file your taxes. Now, normally I would go through a tax return. I'm not going to do that here because it would take quite a bit of time to do that. I did go through a tax return line by line back in episode 6, Navigating Your Tax Return and the One-Page Financial Plan back in March of 2024. So if you really want to hear about line by line for a tax return, a 1040, feel free to go back to that episode, but I'm not going to do that here in the interest of time. Now, let's talk a little bit about how taxes work and when do you actually need to file a tax return. If your income is below the standard deduction, technically, you don't need to file a tax return. However, you may want to in order to receive a refund because you may have had federal taxes withheld from your paycheck, or you might be eligible for various tax credits. But technically, you don't need to file a tax return if your income was below the standard deduction. And for singles, that is $15,750 in 2025. For married filing jointly, it's $31,500. If you're married filing separately, if your income is over $5, you do need to file a tax return. And that's so that the IRS can track what each married filing separately individual is claiming on their tax return. If you are head of household, which is a single parent with a dependent child, That standard deduction is $23,625. So therefore, if you earn less than that, you wouldn't need to file. And if you're a qualifying surviving spouse with a dependent child, so that's eligible for widow or widowers with a dependent child for 2 years following being married, filing jointly, it's the same $31,500. Here's a caveat. If you're a dependent and you're single, so let's say a student that is a dependent of a parent, and you have unearned income, which would be investment income, interest, dividends, and capital gains, that exceeds $1,300, even if your earned income is below the $15,750, you would be required to file a tax return, and that's so the IRS can calculate the kiddie tax, which I won't get into, but if you have investment income and you're dependent of another and your investment income exceeds $1,300, the investment income may need to be reported on the parent's tax return. But if your unearned income is below $1,300 and your earned income is below $15,750, you don't need to file that tax return. But again, you may want to do so to get any federal taxes withheld or any potential tax credits returned to you. So let's talk quickly about how tax rates work. I'll just use the status of single filers to illustrate this. As I mentioned, the standard deduction for a single is $15,750. Effectively, that's the 0% tax bracket. Then we have tax brackets that graduate for every taxable dollar above that figure. The first bracket is 10%, then 12%, then 22%, then 24%, then 32%, 35%, and finally 37%. And the way it works is that for any earned income over that standard deduction, any amount between zero over the standard deduction and $11,925 would be taxed at that 10%. Then the next dollar up to a total of $48,475 of taxable income would be taxed at 12%. And you'll see the progression go up from there. Now, what some people are unaware of is they think that if their income puts them in the 22% tax bracket, for example, that all of their income is taxed at 22%. And that's not true. No matter how much money you make, your first $11,925 of taxable income is taxed at that 10%. The next dollar is then taxed at 12% up to that $48,475 of taxable income, for example. So let's say you had $12,000 of taxable income, which is $75 more than the top of the 10% bracket. Only that additional $75 would be taxed at 12%, and all the amount below that would be taxed at the 10%. So don't fear going into a higher tax bracket. It's only those additional dollars that would be affected by the next bracket. So that's something a number of people are confused about, but that's how it works. Let's talk briefly about a couple of tax credits that might be of interest to many people. There's the child tax credit. That's for dependents under the age of 17. It's $2,200 per child, and part of it is refundable, which means that even if you didn't have a tax liability, up to $1,700 could be refundable as a tax refund. There are other dependent credits. So it could be a parent that is dependent, for instance, or a disabled individual. That would be $500 per other dependent that is non-refundable. There's something called the dependent care credit, which is $3,000 per child up to a $6,000 maximum for child care. If you are working, for example, both parents would need to be working in that case. If it's a married couple, there are education credits, and these are ones that are important to students that I'm talking to. There are two of them. There's the American Opportunity Credit, which is worth $2,500, $1,000 of which is refundable, even if you had no tax liability. And the way it works is the first $2,000 of tuition is 100% refundable, and the second $2,000 is 25% refundable. So 100% of $2,000 plus 25% of the second $2,000 is a total of $2,500, and that's per student on that tax return. And it's for the first 4 years of higher education. There's the lifetime learning credit, which is a 20% credit on up to $10,000 of tuition for a total of $2,000. And that's per return, not per student. So those are two important ones to be aware of if you are a college student, for example, or the parent of a college student. Typically, it's going to be reported on the parent's return. And lastly, there's the earned income credit, which is based on income and number of children, primarily for lower income households. I want to leave it there for the income taxes. I could go really deep into it, but that's kind of a high level coverage of how taxes work for the most part. Most people are going to use some kind of tax software, which usually is going to just ask you about those tax documents you received. And then it's going to ask you a series of questions and fill out the tax return for you. You certainly want to review it and make sure everything is accurate before submitting it. But that's typically what most people will do, or they may hire a tax preparer to do that for them. But remember, the tax return and its information is your responsibility. Even if someone else fills it out, you're the one that is signing that tax return, so you need to make sure it's true and accurate before submitting it. To wrap up this mini-series, I like to conclude with a summary of the major topics we covered during the program with an index card listing 10 key points. I like to think that personal finance really doesn't need to be that complicated. In fact, everything you really need to know can really fit on a 4x6 index card, and that's what I've created here. So let's walk through that. First, I like to title the index card, Make Some, Save and Invest, Live on the Rest. It's the motto of this podcast. It's the motto that my family has followed for many years. And the idea is that obviously you need to have some income, pay yourself first by saving and investing, and then simply live on the difference. Very straightforward. And I like to just remind myself of that, and it makes this whole journey quite simplistic. But let's talk about the 10 key points here. Number one, keep track of all cash flows, incoming and outgoing. That was our first lesson where we talked about tracking income and expenses, and also understanding where your money is going so it can align with your values. Number two is pay yourself first. I like to target a percentage of 20% of your income and then live within your means. Instead of letting savings be the product of whatever is left over at the end of the month, making savings a priority and putting a set percentage of your income to savings and investment, it makes life a lot easier and literally you can just live on the balance. Number three was tracking your net worth, what you own minus what you owe. That was in sessions 2 and 3. And we talked about all of your assets and your liabilities and calculating net worth and trying to grow that net worth over time. Number four is pay off all credit cards in full every month. We had a detailed conversation about how expensive credit card interest rates are and how people can get behind by just paying the minimum payment. So I like to use credit cards for their advantages, but pay them off in full and use them like you would a debit card. And then you get the best of all worlds and not pay interest. The next one is establish an emergency fund. I like to think of 3 to 6 months of living expenses. I would err on the side of 6 months or even more if you're a single member household. If you're in a partnership relationship and there's more than one income earner, you could err on the side of fewer months, maybe 3 months, but that would probably be the minimum I would do. These dollars are for items that are kind of the expected unexpected, things that you know potentially will happen and you're prepared, the big one being a job loss. Number six, harness the power of compounding. The three key components are how much you invest, how much time you invest it for, and the return you receive. That compounding really shows its merit as the timeline increases. It's like a snowball rolling down the hill and gathering size and speed the longer it goes. Number seven is invest in low-cost diversified index funds and don't buy and sell individual securities. Keeping your costs as low as possible, making investing simple, sticking to it, not trading in and out of the market, not worrying about what other people say, and just sticking to your investment policy and keeping your costs as low as possible is probably the easiest way to compound over long periods of time. Number eight, we didn't talk a lot about this, but I like to say a home provides shelter. Purchase only when you're ready and not more than you need. Some people think of homes as an investment. I really look at it as a use asset. When we listed them in assets, it was under the use asset section. The primary purpose of a house is the shelter it provides. And I find too many people buy more house than they need and often earlier than they should. I like to say if you are not planning on living in a house for at least 5 years, you're more likely better off renting, and renting can be good. There are plenty of benefits to being a renter over a homeowner. Homeownership have a lot of costs, and you want to make sure, because they're fixed and they don't go away very easily or changed very easily, you want to make sure you don't overextend yourself when it comes to purchasing a home. Number nine is use debt sparingly and only for items of enduring value and understand all the terms of the loan. I like to think of it as there are certain things that make sense to borrow for. Maybe that's student loan so that you can get a degree and hopefully a higher income potential for the rest of your life. Potentially, you might have to borrow for a house. Again, trying to keep that within reason. But I wouldn't be borrowing money for a vacation or something that is immediately going to be worth nothing, like, let's say, an expensive dinner. I certainly wouldn't borrow for something like that. And you want to make sure you understand all the terms, how much you're borrowing, what is the interest rate, what's the term of the loan, how much interest are you going to pay over the course of the entire loan, and of course, what is the monthly payment. And the last one is protect your financial life with insurance and fraud awareness. Insurance comes in many flavors, the big ones being auto insurance, health insurance, homeowners or renters insurance. Those are the key ones that you should seriously consider. Certainly health insurance, I say you should never go without. And the liability portion for renters is very critical, as well as homeowners. And then being very vigilant when it comes to your identity and protecting it and being aware of all the different types of frauds that are out there, phishing scams and things of that nature. So that's the index card. Hope you like that. It's always something that you can go back to if you ever want to remember what we discussed in the class. It's a nice little cheat sheet for the program and hope you enjoyed that. At the end of the financial literacy class I do at the high school, I always give out some books, and I just want to mention the ones I've decided to give out this year. One of the ones that I like to give out every single year is A Simple Path to Wealth by J.L. Collins, an exceptional book. I also like to give out I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi. I'm not a huge fan of the title. I think it's a little exceptional, but it's a very well-written book. I think it's a great how-to book to organize your personal finances, and I think it's well done. The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. I really like this book. It's just so intriguing and highly recommend that one. And then the last one is Taking Stock by Jordan Grummet. I've asked my daughter in the past which book she really likes, and that's one that comes to the top of her list. So that's another one I like to give out. I hope you enjoyed this 6-part financial literacy miniseries, and I hope you and your family and friends have a wonderful holiday season. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and a review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend the show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next time on the Mark's Money Mind Show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. Now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on the show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.